WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
President Jimmy Carter was 56 when he left the White House in 1981, old enough to qualify for membership in the American Association of Retired Persons, but hardly ready to retire. He has since become a successful author and professor. He and his wife, Rosalind, created the Carter Center to promote democracy and protect human rights, and he's flown around the world helping to mediate in civil wars and international disputes. Now that he's in his 70s, Carter reflects on getting older in his new book, The Virtues of Aging. After his presidency, he and Rosalind returned home to Plains, Georgia, and faced something many retired couples face, more time home together, perhaps too much time. The Carters learned they needed to give each other a lot of private space, to keep separate except for times that they'd scheduled to be together. I asked him how they first realized that too much time together was the source of tension.
Well, it was after I left the White House that we found that we would be confronting each other in the same house all day long and not have a job outside, although we do a lot of things now outside that we didn't anticipate then. Also, when I lost the election in 1980, I discovered to my horror that a very successful business that I had put into a blind trust when I went to the White House was now $1 million in debt. We had moved back to Plains, Georgia, a town that had a population of 600. Our last child was leaving home. We didn't have a job. We didn't know what in the world we were going to do. And so Rosa and I have evolved a lifestyle over, after some difficulty, I might admit, in adjusting to each other, so that we respect each other's privacy. We know now, after a number of years, what times of day we get together. But during the work periods, when we were writing a book, for instance, that's how we make our living now, writing books, we respect each other's privacy. And we don't encroach on it.
You write a little bit about reconciling differences within your relationship with Rosalind. And you say that, you know, your families were so different by temperament. Her family would always get together with these big reunions and just sit around the table and talk, talk, talk. And in your family, there were never reunions like that. And when you did sit around the table, if people did talk, it had to be about important issues. And you say one of the reasons why your family didn't get together for big reunions all the time is that your grandfather and great-grandfather were killed in arguments. So these big reunions were a little bit dangerous. And I started wondering, well, what were the arguments that they were killed over?
Well, my great-grandfather was killed, according to the newspaper articles at the time, in a dispute with his partner over the proceeds of a flying Jenny, which was a merry-go-round that they had built together and they leased out to children, and they got in an argument, and my grandfather was killed, my great-grandfather.
Was he shot or knifed? Or?
He died as a result of knife wounds. Uh-huh. And then my grandfather had a thread case stolen from the front of his little store, and he was told who had stolen the thread case. It was a man named Will Tolliver. And my grandfather went to get the thread case, and Will Tolliver called my grandfather a liar, and they fought each other with their fists for a while, and then my grandfather left to go back to his store, and Tolliver went into his place and got a pistol and shot my grandfather in the back and killed him. So my father died a natural death, I might add, and I very rarely get into arguments. But one of the key reasons that our meal discussions have always been so intense is that my mother ordained when I was a child that all of us could read at the table. And she did. She was an avid reader. And so almost by default, any discussion that we had with each other had to be more interesting than what we were reading. And this kind of limited the discussions to things that were controversial or important to us. And that's just the way we lived. In fact, Amy was severely criticized when she went to her first state dinner at the White House and took a book with her. And while I think Marshal Tito was making his toast, which lasted a long time, Amy was reading a book, and the next day the Washington Post had some critical comments to make about anyone who would read at the table. Was not very polite. But this has been the the aspect of my family. My father had first cousins who lived 10 miles from us, whom I never met. But Rosa knew all of her first, second, third, and fourth cousins who lived within 50 miles, who came to a family reunion every year at the same Sunday in July and in October.
Were you ever afraid when you were running for office, whether it was local office or president, that these stories about the murders of the two men in your family would become public and would somehow be used against you to tarnish your character?
You know, the most complete genealogy that has ever been done about me was done by the National Enquirer, who got the records from the Mormon Church records and also hired the seven most outstanding genealogists in the nation to do studies of different aspects of my family's life. And they published almost an entire edition of their newspaper late in 1977, I think it was. But it's a treasure house of actual reports from different courthouses and on records of marriage licenses and deeds of sale of property and wills that go all the way back to about 1640 when my family first came over to Virginia. So, strangely enough, the National Enquirer has done the most reporting, and they were the ones who really emphasized and proved by current courthouse records and newspapers that my great-grandfather and my grandfather were indeed killed.
Jimmy Carter's my guest. His new book is called The Virtues of Aging. You say one thing we must do nowadays is prepare for long, drawn-out illnesses near the end of life, now that there's the medical technology to sustain us through long, chronic illnesses. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about living wills or where, if any place, you'd want to draw the line if you had a debilitating chronic illness.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I wrote about that in the book. My father, my mother, both my sisters and my brother all died from the same illness, and that is cancer. They all smoked cigarettes, and they died, most of them, prematurely. I've never smoked, and that's one reason I have better health, I think. But when my family members approached death, all of them, for some reason, approached it with great equanimity. My sister, Ruth, was a famous evangelist, Ruth Carter Stapleton. My brother and my mother were great humorists, and they were still telling jokes and kidding back and forth with the family members around their bedside when they were approaching death the last few hours. My oldest sister, Gloria, was an avid biker. She had a home, you might say, for motorcyclists who were on the way down to Daytona to race, and they would spend 2 or 3 days with Gloria while she fed them and took care of them and repaired their leather jackets and so forth. When Gloria was on her deathbed in the hospital, we all knew she was going to die with pancreatic cancer. She had the bikers moved into planes, and two motorcyclists were at Gloria's hospital room door 24 hours a day. And when Gloria finally died, her funeral procession was a hearse, and in front of the hearse were 37 Harley-Davidson motorcycles. And carved on Gloria's tombstone in Plains is she rides in Harley Heaven. So you can see that that death in our family has not been a sordid, morbid, psychologically wrenching experience. We all know we're going to pass on sometime, and we've tried to approach it in a reasonable way. And to get back finally to your question, Rosa and I both have living wills. We want to pass away the same way my family members have, without tubes and without an artificial extension of our life. It's very costly. So we have ordained already legally that we die a natural death.
You said that one of the most interesting and gratifying responsibilities at your age is to decide what to do with accumulated wealth and possessions. And you and Rosalind are planning to leave a substantial portion of your estate to the Carter Center. And I'm wondering how you've both decided what's the right thing to do, you know, by your country and by your children. You know, how much to give to the Carter Center, how much to leave for your children. I think that's, you know, for people who are lucky enough to be in that position, it's a difficult question.
Well, I think almost everyone is in that position to some degree. You know, we might only have a small bank account, or we might only have a house and a lot. But this is something that we faced after reaching, you might say, retirement age. And we had not considered it before, but in my book, I give some simple advice on what everybody should do. One fact that we can't avoid is that we have all of us in the United States have a major heir, the same one, and that's the U.S. government. If we don't plan our estate, then a major portion of it, maybe sometimes almost all of it, will go to the U.S. government instead of the people about whom we care, or the other projects or the entities about which we are concerned. So we finally agreed that we would, Rose and I did, that we would have all our children come down home for one Thanksgiving weekend, for instance, and we discussed with them, very frankly, everything that we owned. And we took them around and showed them the boundary lines of our land. We discussed with them, what do you want us to leave to you? Would you rather us skip you with some of our estate and give it directly to your children, that is, mine and Rosen's grandchildren? Rosen and I have decided with counsel from estate planners how much of our estate to leave to the Carter Center. The point is that no matter who we are, we ought to make some plans about what kind of legacy we want.
My guest is former President Jimmy Carter. He has a new book called The Virtues of Aging. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jimmy Carter is my guest. His new book is called The Virtues of Aging. Well, I want to remind you of something that I know you haven't forgotten, which is that when you mentioned to Playboy having once had lust in your heart, you fell 15 points in the approval ratings after that. So I'm wondering what your reaction has been to what the polls have to say about President Clinton since the Starr report came out documenting that, you know, saying that he had oral sex in the White House.
Well, I made the serious mistake in the campaign in 1976 against Gerald Ford of almost losing the election. I dropped from 18 points ahead, 15 points in the public opinion polls within a week because of that Playboy interview. All I did was to quote one verse in the Sermon on the Mount about not being condemnatory toward other people. If someone has committed adultery, then someone who's looked with lust on a woman or a man shouldn't criticize. And Playboy asked me if I had ever looked with lust on a woman other than Rosa, and I said yes. That's all it was. But it turned out to be almost a catastrophic political mistake. Well, times have changed, obviously, over a period of now 20 years. And I don't have any feeling of resentment or persecution because the public looks with a different attitude toward the allegations against President Clinton. We have a little different reaction, I guess, between President Ford and me. We are very close friends, and we have discussed these revelations, and it's a little bit of a special problem for someone who's lived in the White House, who revered the Oval Office and the White House almost like a religious place where Abraham Lincoln has lived and Franklin Roosevelt has lived, and Woodrow Wilson has lived, and Harry Truman has lived and served our country. So there's a personal aspect of it that causes me some concern. My hope now is that this investigation and hearings in the House can be expedited as rapidly as possible and get it over with. I think it's very likely that a highly charged Republican House of Representatives, if they still have a majority after the election next Tuesday, will see that it's to their advantage and to the nation's advantage to end the ordeal. I don't think there's any chance in the world that the Senate would vote to remove President Clinton from office. There's certainly no chance that he's going to resign from office. So President Clinton will finish his term, and there'll be some aftermath of the charges and allegations against him, I think maybe in history. But I just hope it'll soon be over.
So you're hoping that the Congress will have some kind of deal that they could put together to just end it?
Yes, I think that's going to come. The Senate is not going to ignore the charges if it gets to the Senate, and I think it's a chance that it will. I think there'll be some negotiated agreement between the Congress and the White House, you know, provided there are no other revelations made, or provided there are no other surprises in store, and I don't think there will be.
If you could write the scenario yourself, would you want to see President Clinton resign or stick it out in office?
Well, I think it's inevitable that he'll stick it out in office, and that's what I would prefer, of course.
If President Clinton did have sex in the White House with Monica Lewinsky, how serious is that, do you think?
That in itself is not serious at all as far as legal aspects are concerned, or as far as his performance of his duties are performed. And if you notice, none of the allegations that are now being considered by Chairman Hyde and the House Judiciary Committee have anything to do with sex. They involve not telling the truth, and they involve possible abuses of power and so forth. So legally, I think the sexual acts, if they did occur, don't have any impact on his performance of duty or on the legalities of the impeachment hearings.
What about the weight of lying about consensual sex? How much weight do you think that should have? Should it have the same weight as, say, lying about Watergate or Iran-Contra?
There is a more serious nature of lying about anything to the American public and to the a grand jury by someone who has sworn to enforce the laws of our nation than to lie to one's own family members about whether one did or did not violate marriage laws. So obviously it's more serious to have lied to one's cabinet, to the American people, and to the grand jury if these allegations are proven to be true, than just to try to protect the reputation of one's lover or to protect the sensitivities of one's wife. But I'm not the one to make a judgment, and I'm answering these questions with some degree of reluctance, as you may be able to
tell. I noticed. Is it hard for a former president to pass judgment on a president?
Well, it is, because I see, as certainly President Bush and Ford would see, the diverse nature of people who've served in the White House. We're all different, just like news reporters are all different from each other, and farmers are all different from each other, and lawyers are all different from each other. So presidents are different. We do different things after we leave the White House. We set different standards of performance for ourselves. We set different priorities for our nation. We relate to the Congress and to the Supreme Court in different fashions, but we're all bound by the same laws. We all have taken exactly the same oath of office to uphold the integrity of our office, to carry out and enforce the laws of our nation as interpreted by the Supreme Court. So we are bound by the same rules, but we respond to them in office and after we leave office in different ways. And I think that's inevitable.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. You had some good questions.
Jimmy Carter's new book is called The Virtues of Aging.